Everybody, this is Joe from Cordova's, and you're listening to Walking the Floor with Chris Shiflett and me, Joe Firstman. Keep it rolling.
I'm walking the floor over you.
Walking the floor.
I'm walking the floor.
Walking the floor over you.
Hola, señores and señoritas. Holy moly, I don't know about you, but I just watched Andy Ruiz knock out Anthony Joshua on the TV, and there's a new heavyweight champion. Unbelievable. What a stunning, crazy upset of a fight. A really good fight. If you didn't watch it, I suggest you get to your computer and stream that thing now, because that was unreal. I'm stunned right now, honestly. Anywho, oh, I forgot. This is Walking the Floor. My name's Chris Shiflett. Welcome. Welcome, friends and listeners. You know, I don't know if you checked it out, but just this last week, we dropped the fourth and final track from my record, Hard Lessons, that's coming out in a couple of weeks. But we dropped the final track before the record comes out, and it's a duet with me and my good buddy Elizabeth Cook, and it's called The One You Go Home To. And if you haven't listened to it, go to Spotify, go to Apple Music, go to Amazon Prime Music or whatever that thing's called, or go wherever you get your music and check it out. It's out there. It's like a nasty old school honky tonk duet, but with like revved up nasty guitars and that sort of thing. And Elizabeth Cook kills it on it. She's awesome. And if you dig that, then get on over to my website, chrisshiflettmusic.com. And check out, there's tickets for sale for my West Coast run of shows. There's like four shows in July, July 10th in Costa Mesa, July 12th at Pappy and Harriet's, July 13th up in Bakersfield, and then bringing it all home July 14th here in Los Angeles, California at the Moroccan Lounge, and there's still plenty of tickets for all those gigs, so get out there and get your tickets today, chrisshiflettmusic.com. All right, let's pay some bills. You know, support for Walking the Floor comes from D'Addario. D'Addario, you know D'Addario, a fine maker of USA-made instrument strings and musical accessories, like those little clip-on tuners that are awesome. I love them. They are committed to sustainability through the Playback Program, recycling over 1 million used instrument strings. So for more information on the Playback Program, get on over to playback.daddario.com. And you know, Zounds.com's a longtime supporter of Walking the Floor, and nobody makes the best gear from the best brands more affordable than Zounds. You never have to pay full price all at once when you buy it from Zounds, and if you use their exclusive payment plans, you can create music. Not, how am I going to pay for this, headaches? And they make it as easy for you as possible, so get on over there today, Zounds.com. All right, let's talk to Joe. You know, I never met Joe Firstman from the Cordovas until we did this interview a few months back, but I dig this guy's spirit, dig his vibe. We talked a lot in this interview about songwriting and musicality and all kinds of cool muso stuff. He's had a really cool career and a cool journey through music, from like, you know, being on major labels and being on TV and being a band leader on Carson Daly, to, you know, making many, many solo records, and then the work that he's done with the Cordovas. And he's like a real true artist, songwriter, singer, just vibe master, cool dude. And I hope you dig this interview like I did. This is Joe Firstman from the Cordovas on Walking the Floor.
Let me know. It's breaking me down.
It's funny, every time I hear your band name, even though it's not quite the same word, I don't know if you're old enough to remember those car ads.
Yes.
With Ricardo Montalban.
Yes.
Where you go, Cordova.
Fine. Corinthian leather.
Yes.
Never have I seen one in my life. I was born in 79, so I was close.
Okay, so you're the cutoff
bros
there.
Bros saying it to me is how I know it.
Oh, okay. Yeah. Oh,
kind of bros that are a little older than me.
Right,
and, and then one time I was looking at an old Playboy or something, and the fucking ad was in there.
Like, there it is. Yeah, I think it was Cordova. I don't even remember what kind of car that
Chrysler
was.
Chrysler Cordova.
There you
fine
go.
Fine Corinthian leather.
Boom. That should be what you guys tour in.
What the fuck?
Our touring truck's right out there.
Nice.
Or at least we just do a throwback of like the Corinthian leather ad, and I become Ricardo Montalban.
Perfect. For like the over 40 set, we'd love it. That's a whole new niche market for you guys.
We can get that. We can really match the film.
Aging Fantasy Island fans.
Thank you. This is another show I just, you know.
There's a great thing I discovered on YouTube a few years ago when you're going down the YouTube rabbit hole of like somebody out there has compiled all the shows that were on for like every year.
Wow.
So you can go to like, you know, 1979. And there'll be like the ad for every single show that was on like network television at that time. And it's fucking amazing because you don't remember like 98% of them.
Right. Now, Knight Rider would be nice.
That's your starting point?
It's kind of when I first start remembering things. Okay. And Knight Rider, Magnum P.I. I remember
there you go.
That one.
That was a big one for me. Okay. That was a big one
for me. That's like 83 kind
of? Yeah, I probably would have been in there.
Okay.
Yeah. Okay, we're off track already. The interview has gone horribly awry.
We're on it, man.
We're on track.
We're on track. This is good stuff, man.
Are you on your way to Mexico right now? Is that what you're doing? You guys are on the road, but are you working your way down to Mexico?
Correct. We kind of finished this tour with this great singer named El King, and it happened to end in L.A., thank God. And so we were like, well, we're going to go to L.A. for 6 weeks. I've lived here for a long time, and we've filled in as many shows as we could, and then, you know, then do the flights from here down to Mexico.
But this is like a yearly woodshedding songwriting thing that you guys go do, right?
I mean, I started doing it. I built this place in 07 or 08.
Oh, so you built a place down there?
I bought the land when I was on TV. I came down there and like, what am I going to do? You know, this TV gig is going to end, and I feel it ending.
Right.
And what am I going to do? And I was like, well, if it all goes to hell, then I'll go live in Mexico and surf, and then I'll just pop up to the States and go on tour in a car solo. And that's how it went down. And then it became more and more friends coming down. And then, you know, the Peter Buck started doing his festival down there. And then, you know, it just became kind of...
Is that what the Tropic of Cancer concert series is?
Tropic of Cancer, first of all, the actual Tropic of Cancer goes through town. So that's right. Where we got the name from. John Paul Jones, Peter came, man. I mean, you know, he's mad at us and stuff, but...
oh, really?
Yeah.
Oh, I missed all this.
Yeah, I mean, okay. It's like he came... I'm surfing one day. Like,
right.
And I'm cruising back through town from the wave, and I look over there, and I'm like, that's dude from R.E.M. And like,
wait, Peter Buck surfs?
No, he just moved there.
Oh, okay.
And he proceeded to throw a really great party for maybe 5 years, and he brought like the Truckers and Connor and Dawes and... a lot of big acts.
Yeah.
That was really wild for this little town. And their party kind of ran out of gas, and you know, we were already doing little gigs here and there, and I was bringing bros down, and it was the natural thing for us to kind of just take. The big stage had been built, man, and they kind of asked me to take over.
Right.
And that's how it fell into from just being truly shedding songwriter sessions with my boys and a few little gigs for the tourist to like, oh man, you know, Joan Osborne.
Right. This is like a real real festival.
Right. I mean, look, dude, we got in there and they were going to do it. And the guy came to me and he said, what do you need? I want to help you do the party. And that was how we did it. I mean,
okay. Well, so how does that work though? So what is the songwriting component versus how does that tie into the festival thing? Like, do you go down there with a bunch of ideas or do you just go down there like, let's just get freaky and see what happens?
I invite almost everybody I meet over the course of the year. Coast to coast, worldwide. Okay,
that's what I'm really leading to is how do I get an invite? That's you're like a in. Whole line of
You've
questions.
You've been invited. Okay, I mean, seriously, it's like it's the biggest guys. It's Joan Osborne all the way down to the kid who opened up for us in Costa Mesa last
night.
I shook hands with him. Show, dude, you can get down there. I'll find a show for you.
Nice.
So that really began as the place that, you know, you come see my house. It's a palapa, dude. I mean, we can write some songs there.
Right.
It's set up for it.
It sounds like the type of thing, though, that could like take your year over in planning. Like, how much does that eat into your...
All year.
Right.
Yeah. A lot of stress.
Right.
I kind of just like this year, I trained this other guy to help me do it. And there's so much that just can't be done, man. Dealing with agents is not really exactly what I want to be doing, you know, but...
I know how those conversations go. They just sort of drag on, you know.
And they also are waiting for the next better thing. I like to go artist to artist and get, you know, like I have a really great band, Susto, is friends with BJ. I think you know him from American Aquarium.
Sure.
And they're from Charleston. I just love them. And I just wanted You know, like, I just want to talk to the singer, man. Just show up and I'll get the plane tickets. And
right. It's the same with doing this podcast. When you're dealing with people's, like, teams, it's a lot harder than when you're just kind of dealing with somebody direct. You know what I mean?
I see you over there, bro.
Yeah.
And that's how we do it. And guys were coming and writing songs. Certainly the Cordovas wrote our whole record that, you know, the RATO
the latest one. Right.
And the next one we'll refine down there. It's largely written. But that was the main thing, man. And so then the other bros are kind of like musicians like us.
Yeah.
And they want to write songs. And Luca's in our band. He's a great poet. And Toby, every time he start playing a G, it's like it's already a song. So we've got a factory down there and we've got a lot of people that want to write. And I write with anybody, man.
Right.
I write with the janitor and the king or whatever, you know. Like,
I mean, how does that work? Is everybody in your band a songwriter?
Yeah.
How do you manage that?
Take all the ideas. This thing where I was listening to one of my friends who's got a big band talk about his process, and it was that he needed to go off by himself, and I think the wizard going to the top of the mountain is a romantic idea to gather his powers and how the whole world comes through you and you're so smart and brilliant. Maybe more practical to sit down with a pen in your hand and some bros and some guitars.
Right. Agreed. I find like the collaboration always, for me at least, seems to render a better tune.
How is two brains not better than one? I don't. And then once we got our two brains, and then we go outside and say, "Hey, janitor, bro, what do you think of this part?" He's like, "I don't know," or "That's pretty good." You know, watch his face. Watch how they react. Watch how people are giving compliments or not. Like, take in the family, take in the community.
But is that hard when, like, how many people are in your band?
There's five of us.
Five of you. So is that, do you ever get into that situation like, I only got one song on the record and I got these three that you guys didn't give enough time to, you know what I mean? Does that sort of egos and things like that ever enter the equation?
It's certainly part of the historical aspects of what we know of rock bands, you know?
Sure. Like
Rick Parker, my mentor, always used to say, every band's cursed. And you know, I see what he means because of your questions. The ego is so embedded into everything. In our band, no.
Well, songwriting's like, it's like the most personal thing you can, one of the most personal things you can do. So it's impossible, I think, for it not, you know, your ego and your pride to not be kind of wrapped up in that.
I don't want to say impossible. And I know it's hard. I had a session with a songwriter the other day. My way is, we're going to go quick. We're going to just really identify the weaknesses quick. And if that's not the kind of session that you're prepared to have, then me and you ain't going to be writing songs.
Right.
The guy who I write songs with in Cordova is Luca. He didn't need me to tell him about my ideas. He went back and listened to my catalog. He understood where I was, my strengths, my weaknesses. And then I made sure that when I was discussing his own song, he'd bring these beautiful, almost perfect pieces of clay that he had managed into a figure.
Yeah.
But they weren't quite right. The perspective, the arm was too short. He had to be open-minded enough to listen right out of the gates. And I had to be clear and concise enough to make him believe in me.
Right.
And now we got something.
Yeah.
And so then the idea of, like, you know, like on the live show, I sing 80% of the stuff. I don't know. I got all the fast songs. We ain't trying to do ballads all night. The whole record is, it's Luca. It's Luca's poems.
Mm.
It's my arrangement and my sense of harmony. But man, I mean, he wrote this world and handed me so much raw material.
You just mentioned harmony. You guys have crazy harmonies, like beautiful harmonies, multi-part harmonies. How do you guys sort of stack those? Do you have like a process that you go through to put those together to kind of build them?
Big time. It's the thing that we work on by far the most. It's the thing that we, you know, when we're listening back to the show, like we played last night in Costa Mesa, we're listening back on the ride, just every single note that I'm even a cent off, it's grinding.
Mm.
Whereas when I was assigned a young man on Atlantic 20 years ago, I didn't know how to sing in tune. I didn't know how to sing.
Right.
I mean, I guess I could sing better than everybody in Charlotte or, you know, like at my high school.
Right.
But to do this thing for real, man, you know, it's not that easy.
Yeah.
And so it took me a long time to learn how to sing. And now, you know, like you don't have to yell and you're learning. And then, oh, man, that's how Jerry does that. That's how he's getting that tone.
Yeah.
It becomes this beautiful religious thing.
Especially when you have multiple voices singing together.
I always say you can sing about dog shit on the side of the street. Well, three-part harmony sound pretty good. Dog shit. You know, lay that baby in there and it's like, that sound pretty good. Yeah. You know, what if you didn't know what English?
Yeah.
And then basically you have us dudes singing three-part harmony in the Southern vernacular pretty much.
it's time tested, this blues thing.
Yeah. Well, how does, I mean, I read that you guys all live together.
Yes.
And the way it was described, like, was you're just kind of like in the, you know, almost like in the creative process, like all the time, you yes. know, just to, in your lives.
Yes. What I like to have, man, and what we're trying to do there at the, you know, we call it at headquarters in Nashville, and the barn is always set up and the lights are always looking cool in there. And man, you hear a guy over there in the barn picking a little melody out, and another bro's out there doing the leaves. You're supposed to put the rake down and go join them. One guy's cooking the food, the other guy's, you know, went to get the beers, and the other guy's down there working on the part of that song from that day. And now he's prepared. And you don't have to ask, yo, did you get your piano part? You know that he did.
Right.
Everybody's ready to go.
Well, no, that's I think that's like an interesting, not trick, but like an interesting aspect of bands like your bands, that like when some of your songs like sounds totally spontaneous, like I hate to use the term jam band, but great. I'll just say, you know, they sound a little jammy, you know great. What I mean? But when you sort of listen to, I was listening to, you know, to get ready to interview, and I was like, God, I bet that's worked out than I think it is. Worked out, but it sounds like off the cuff, but like it really off the cuff generally doesn't sound that good. It's, you know what I mean?
You're identifying something that I've heard at least the few writers that write about our band really are trying to articulate that right. very thing in there. What I technically think it is that we are personally doing on purpose, that we are absolutely consciously doing, is really specifically working out the guitar parts. I mean, crazily tight. Hmm. And the drums, very crazy tight, like not too sloppy, not too swishily. Hi-hats usually closed.
Right, right. Not taking up too much space.
No, I don't want the air to be blocked with that cascading thing. So, and then I noticed on the Dead records that I love so much that, man, you know, some of those live shows, it could have been a slightly different sound recording that night. And sometimes the guitars are so forward and it never bothers you as long as they're playing right.
Right, right.
And that sound. And then what do we have left? Me on bass, a piano player, a baseball player, really. I want it to present that every idea that is coming to me, I'm giving to you, and present that this is only happening right now for you. And that is how it, to me, how we offset the, it's so tight, but then you're kind of like, this guy's like spinning up here. Who knows what he's doing?
Yeah.
We're doing that on purpose.
It's, and did you record your latest record live?
All live. Vocals
really?
Too.
Vocals too. Get out.
Kenneth from Milk Carton Kids.
What kind
we're
of...
Going, we're not close, dude. And he would go, you're close. Do another take.
Right.
You know.
What kind of pre-production went into being able to do that?
Learning how to be in band, the whole thing. Because it wasn't just the pre-production. It was having, you know, my girlfriend bought us a house in Nashville. She's a physician. She bought us a house. That was part of the thing. We needed it, you know, like the concept of like going across town to rehearsal and then getting back in your car, like after getting your mind straight for rehearsal. Like, no. How are we going to get anything done?
You know what sounds amazing about that to me? The thing that pops right out at me is how hard it is, even in the best of circumstances, to get four or five guys in a room together
right.
to make everybody's schedule meet right. up. So if you just live together, problem solved.
Problem solved, man.
Yeah.
And that's the thing is you get be up, always be ready for a little Instagram picture. Man, we're a struggling band. We got, you know, I got $5. Do what you can do to do something today. If bro's over there doing some damn Blind Willie McTell, turn them a little bit towards the light and turn on your phone and record them doing it, man. We're a special band. We have guys that actually like to play. I forgot the question because there's another thing, but...
I was just wondering, like, you know, pre-production going in it to be ready there it is. To cut.
For the first time, really, you know, I had major label deals and I'd done, you know, open for Sheryl Crawley's tours and I'd booked my own tours. And
yeah.
This is the first time I felt like this is what touring is. I mean, do 250 shows. In the last 2 years, each year.
Really? So even leading into making the record?
Yes.
Because the record came out in August, but when did you make it?
We were already on the road.
Right, okay.
Okay, we already went back touring. The label in Sweden put out our first record that was done years ago, and that kind of, like, you're going to put out our record on vinyl and bring us on tour? Okay.
So that kind of breathed life into. Well, why was there this long gap between those two records? Is it the same band of people?
No, just me and the guitar player, Toby, who I grew up with. Okay. Same street. I was going on
playing solo, the Atlantic thing was dead. The television show was dead.
Right.
I'm driving around in my dually, and I'm flying back to Mexico in the winter and trying to figure out how to write songs again or whether I was good at in the first place. And I got a trio, and they get pissed off and leave in the middle of the night, and I call my boy Toby, who I grew up with. He's a magnificent player. He's crawling under houses with a flashlight, you know, getting asbestos. And I go, dude, jump on the road. We're going. And it rekindled that thing we had in junior high, and like singing harmony with a bro. Like we forgot. Right. It was so natural for us.
This the beginning of the Cordovas?
Yes.
Because the first record came out, 2011?
Yeah.
And then the new record comes out now. But in that time, you're putting out a bunch of solo records,
yes.
Right?
With my boy helping and people sitting right. in and just still developing the Cordova sound, but just didn't have my guys. And then we had that one 2011, and we had one tour, but it was just like, how do we keep it together? Right. How do you
pay
for this?
Well, this is the thing that I'm always fascinated. I'm always fascinated with bands that have been around. You know, it's never, there's never any overnight success, right?
Right.
But I love when there's a band that's getting a lot of heat, getting a lot of attention, has a buzz around them, like you guys seem to right now. And you sort of go, well, what's the backstory here? You know, I've never heard of these guys until this record came out. Now it's all over the place kind of
right.
thing. And then you look into it and there's this long backstory.
Yeah.
You know, so I guess, you know, how did it happen that it took so long between those? Did the band like make a record, break up, and then kind of get back together with a new lineup? Or what was the...
I think... When I got here, man, when I was 20, I had a plan. I don't know what it was, but it was probably something similar to your plan when you were 20. You know, I don't know.
I'm going to move to LA and get gobbled up by a major. Woo!
It happened in like 6 months.
Really?
Yes.
No shit.
Yes. I'm sitting at the Peninsula with my sleeves cut off and the president of Atlantic going, you ready to do whatever it takes? And I was like, you got it, Craig. And then all the things were thrown at me. And I feel like we made a good record. But... the inevitable dissension was imminent. It was going to happen. I felt it. I wrote about it. I foreshadowed it. And it was a long, you know, my cousin writes, who's one of my lyric partners, Rock Bottom Will Set You Free. I don't know if it was Rock Bottom. It was a long damn way down the hole. And
what,
I didn't know.
Was the experience of being on a major label?
Of that high.
Right.
And then coming down from there.
Right.
You know,
the expectation.
Seemingly unspendable money. I mean, extinguishable bank account.
Right.
Backed up by a television show that was also, you know, high.
Were you doing that at the same time?
No, they were right next to it. I got Atlantic ended. I think we're going to drop you. Fuck you. I could get a new deal. Right. Of course I would, right?
Right, yeah.
No one was really waiting, you know. Mm. And then the television show, like, limo service, you know, you're on TV now. Okay, great. So I buy the place in Mexico.
And how did that happen? How did the television thing come along?
I played Carson's show on the first record cycle on Atlantic. I'd see him in the bars in LA. He'd come over and sing the word. He knew my songs.
Mm.
And then my friend Danny Masterson and I were doing a little jazz club in Beverly Hills. There's several in LA now. We were the original dudes. Thundercat, Kamasi, Zamusa, Zancarney, the kings of jazz right now
right.
in our band.
Right.
And I'm on TV and giving those guys gigs on the house, man. I'd have Mark Ford from the Crows mixing with Kamasi and Thundercat on bass, dude. I mean, it was like
crazy.
I was by far the worst guy up there and learning all the stuff, which is an important part of that thing. So to get back to the point, I mean, that of course ended and you know, all that gone. You start getting there like, what's happening? I used to be you make a record every year, man. This is just what I do. I write songs, you record them. It's just a snapshot of your life. You keep going, you get crippled. You get so, maybe you lose your confidence.
Was that kind of daily gig, did that have a positive or a negative effect on your own creative output? Because I know for me, if I'm like touring a lot or I'm kind of focused on the one aspect of being a musician, a lot of times like I'll let my songwriting suffer.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? And then I go, oh, fuck, I got all these ideas. I got to spend some time doing that.
I remember just... the record, I made this record called El Porto, which is, you know, I lived over there in Manhattan Beach. It was just so
okay, so that is Manhattan Beach you're referring to.
Yeah.
Okay. And you surf?
Oh, yeah.
Okay.
I came there.
Did you get out today?
No.
Because it's pumping today.
Monstrous.
Yeah.
It's toe in.
Yeah, in some places. Not here. Not up in Malibu.
It was like 200 yards to even get to the wave in El Porto.
Yeah, El Porto would probably be a nightmare right now.
Because bro hit me up this morning and he was like, you ready to go surfing? I was like, I looked out the window. I was like, are you sure?
No, it wasn't that bad where I was at.
Okay, did you surf?
I did, yeah.
Nice.
Yeah, I did.
Where over here?
My buddy grew up in Malibu, so up past Zuma.
Okay,
ways. It's like a, you know, it's like a private beach. Dude. So there were no crowd. It was great.
You can edit this part. I mean, my boy Jimmy, they do the same thing. He comes from Manhattan Beach to go surfing north, and then he comes back to his studio in Venice every day, and they hang their wetsuits.
Yeah,
it's the shit.
Nice. I gotta meet that guy.
You gotta meet this guy. So yeah, dude, the inevitable kind of all that ended. We're in the middle. I don't have a band. I don't have shit going on. I'm touring solo. The promoter in Des Moines, Iowa has this kid, Luca, opening up for me, and he's got his thing, and he looks like Bob Dylan, and he's singing, you're singing like this. And I'm smoking a joint with him after, and I was like, dude, that's a great song. I'll be down in Nashville. Well, you come find me, bro. You know, I'm moving down there. Great. He came and found me. He showed me his songs. I couldn't believe that they were his. And I said, oh, let's start a band. And then I called Toby. I was like, I got a guy for us now, dude.
Nice.
Now we're ready.
Right.
And it took Toby, you know, he had to suffer through a divorce to get himself free to be able to join us again. Mm. And then, you know, my girlfriend steps in and says, well, you guys did that. Now here's the house. Here you go.
Get to work,
boys. So back to that pre-production question. I mean, dude, we were playing so much. I mean, we could go into the studio. We could do our record right here in your studio right now. We know the songs like Let It Be or something, you know.
That's got to be a great feeling to step on stage with that kind of confidence.
I was having a meeting with a band this morning, and I was telling them the same thing. Dude, you want to have your hour ready to go. Like, you could play it while you're so sick or you're on mushrooms or whatever. Like,
right.
That's power.
Right.
When you're a nobody band, because the sound changes every night. The girls, the cashier's going, the thing got broke, the glass fell, you know, the tables are squeaking. Just laser vision.
That's a special kind of powerful feeling when you are so confident in what you're doing that it doesn't even matter if people are not paying attention or there's only 20 people there or whatever the stumbling block of the night is.
It's the great equalizer, that 20 people thing, man. Does it really matter if it was 20 or it was the 75 grand that you guys were playing? I'm selling. It's still a show.
Right.
It's just a show.
Yeah.
And your ass was still doing the same damn thing anyway.
Yeah.
So I really, you know, look, man, getting rid of the false shell was the biggest part of all of this.
Well, let's back up a little bit. Where did you grow up? Just said Charlotte. Okay, a minute ago. So
my mom's an opera singer. Her family's a southern side. They all sing country music, harmony. And my dad is a fine, fine Travis picker, like Doc Watson style.
No shit.
Yes.
Okay, well, that answers that question of where you got the music bug from.
People could play.
So your mom's an opera singer that sings country?
Her sisters were all great singers, but she chose opera. She went into the thing and learned to train her voice for that. But all the girls, I mean, all her sisters and brothers can pick, and I'd go up there and they'd be singing perfect three-part.
No shit.
Leaving on a jet plane, you know, when I was a little boy.
What are your earliest musical memories?
Her sisters and her singing Leaving on a Jet Plane in Shelby.
Hmm.
The prettiest thing I ever heard. My mom made me, I could sing harmony early, and my mom got me up in front of people at Temple and stuff like that, and I was pretty stone cold about it. I wasn't nervous. I enjoyed it, and singing harmony with my mom and watching them do it. My dad and her could sing harmony, although they didn't have like a hippie thing going on. They hated each other.
Right.
Those are the memories, man, kind of seeing them play.
And so when did you start playing? And what did you say, your keyboardist first?
Piano was there.
Right.
And so, you know, my mom was like, you know, take piano lessons. Of course, I was like a baseball player and trying to roll around in the dirt and did not abide by her wishes. But when she left, I go play piano, of course.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Right.
I taught myself.
And then, how funny. I would love to think that my kids are doing that when I leave the room, but something tells me they're not.
How old are they?
Oh, 15, 12, and 10.
Wow.
And they all play a little bit, you know, but it's not really like a passion for any of them yet. But I like try to keep them in it just in case they get there, you know. But I don't know. It's weird. It's weird when your dad does it for a living. I think there's maybe it's less of there's not as much mystery there maybe. I don't know what it is.
What if your dad just liked it but wasn't able to do it for a living? Maybe it would allow them to like want to have to continue My dad, poor God bless him, he probably won't listen to this, but you know, he was one of those guys that he you know, went to Atlanta after he came out of NAMM, and he had his beautiful long black hair and skinny and playing the guitar, and he showed up and they liked his song,
right?
And then they said, you will go, okay, give me 20 more or whatever and come back. And it was just impossible. I remember him telling me, well, you have to have so many songs, you got, he told me one time, you have stars in your eyes. I'm sitting there playing the piano like, check my song, I'm gonna make a record.
Yeah.
And it seemed like he had just built some idea in his mind that was a little harder than it was. I ain't saying that it's easy. Nothing is. I'm 39 years old. Just learned how to sing yesterday, friends.
Right.
But it's also not that hard.
Right. Well, it's
go
like,
do it.
Yeah, somebody, I don't remember where I heard this, but somebody was talking about writing poetry. And it's something to the effect of like, if you wrote one line of poetry every day, by the end of your life, you'd have like more poetry than anybody ever wants to read, you right. know, in a lifetime. Like,
and you would have
probably, it's sort of the act of like putting one foot in front of the yes. other. And you can't just, yeah, I'm not going to have a catalog of 100 songs tomorrow.
Right.
But you just got to do the work. You right. got to slog it out.
And the thing with poetry is that after the fifth day, you're going to get better. And you're going to see the patterns. You're going to see your weaknesses. You're going to improve. You're going to improve, 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 improve. And that, what a great thing to music to have. It's that, that is the chronicle aspect of music. To listen to your voice when you're 21 and go, oh, you know, I'll play, put my record on. That's pretty, I mean, I like that guy.
Right.
I was impressed.
Right.
It's not great.
Yeah.
I know why it only did 60,000, whatever the, yeah, the yeah. failure that it was. But I like that guy.
It's great when you get enough distance from it that you can listen to it a little objectively.
Big time.
Because I'll listen back to records I made, you know, 20 years ago or something and think like, God, most of that fucking sucks.
Yes.
But there's a couple little things in there that yes. I recognize myself in, you right. know? You
yeah,
know?
Yeah, that was a hard thing for me.
Yeah.
And also the really, the way that I played, man, I saw a lot of my boys and that were coming out of LA and trying their best to get deals and just make a life of it, chasing that, what is the word, you know, some popularity, it's pop, the word, but it's not pop because it's popularity, really.
Right, right, right.
I need the narrative and the songs and the man and the timing and the night to be in line for me to believe in you.
Right.
And I was not going to go out there and not believe in my own words. I would have rather just gotten stoned, blacked out, and played Tom Waits all night, which I did, which ran off my...
Which probably helped.
No, it ran everybody away. And the drunk was just not... It's not a show, but it was my way of going, I can't do that pop record.
Right.
I just can't. Right, I don't believe right. in that.
Were they trying to... Was that like an Atlantic thing? Were they trying to sort of force you into a lane?
Right out of the gates, right. I didn't even understand what a record cycle was, Chris, because I had made my record so... You know, by the time it came out in Atlantic, I'd already had 100 new songs and yeah. we're out on tour and the thing showed up. Oh, cool. So as soon as we got off the big tours and I was in clubs selling lots of tickets and getting there, I didn't play the record.
Right.
I played the shit I wrote that afternoon.
Right.
Because I had
right.
Carl from My Morning Jacket on guitar and Darwin from Colby Kelly and Miley from Rival Sons was my band and I had these great guys and I didn't yeah. care about those. I didn't understand what a record cycle was. I didn't understand what I was trying to sell. I didn't get what I was supposed to talk about in the interview. I was a 10% of a major label artist, not a complete one. The stories that I'm sure you've heard in here, and it was, and your boys, and it didn't work out. Man, they fucked me, and they put all the resources to this new band. The darkness got signed. It was on me.
Right.
It was all on me.
Well, that's really interesting. Okay, so this is your latest record is your first record on ATO, yes. right? Okay, so between Atlantic and ATO. Where were you in all those solo records? Were you putting them out
shitty
yourself?
Shitty deals, putting them out myself, begging
here and there,
begging for a bro. The bros, I got my record camp. You know right. these guys, and
because you got a lot of records.
Yeah,
yeah.
I wish I had more, man. But that the not having like a real avenue for them to go is crushing me for a little bit. Me,
what's it like working with ATO? Because it's there. Would are we calling that a major label or is that an indie or some kind of in between?
I mean, they certainly handle. You know,
they got some big artists over there.
Right? Alabama Shakes won the, so you know, yeah. they can facilitate the. It's a worldwide label,
right?
You know, dude, one of my favorite bands is King Gizzard. I love those Australian band. So with this man, I mean, the head of the label is this guy John Salter. He's just basically been like, I love your sound. I'm ready to see what happens next. I get the impression that he gives the artists autonomy.
Is it a little more hands-off creatively? Like, you go make a great record and we'll figure out how to market it or whatever.
And if it sucks, we're all going to know. It's the same thing with when you say, like, who gets to sing or whatever. No, yeah. dude, the best song gets to sing. Right. Who gets to sing lead? The guy who sounds the best on it. Right. Who gets to sing the third harmony? The guy who sounds the best. Who gets to sing the other one that's not quite as hard? The guy who sounds the worst on the other two.
Yeah.
you know what I mean? You don't have these. It shouldn't be that hard, you know.
Right.
And that's why bands. It's like if you want your solo thing and you want your thing and you're the gypsy and you know fucking tell everybody what to do and you're the boss, do that. Cordova's is everybody.
Right.
And I really want them to own it. I tell them every day, Toby, especially the second guitar player I grew up with. Man, you got to own this. This is your thing.
Right.
take it.
And when did you wind up moving to Nashville?
We came there in like 2.5 years ago, something like
oh,
that.
Okay.
Whatever year it is now, 16.
Right. And what's the music scene out there like? I've spent a bit of time in Nashville, but I haven't really spent a lot of time in like East Nashville. I don't know tons of people out there.
They're kind of like the Dovas, you know, man. I think maybe there's a little bit of like the
LA. I always thought you guys were from California.
Yeah, I think there's right. a little bit of the LA vibe that they maybe don't love about us. I'm from North
Carolina. Those incense burning avocado eating motherfuckers.
Birds right. listening motherfucker. Joshua tree hanging motherfucker.
Right, right.
I love California,
sure.
but you can't beat me, dude. My folks are from Shelby. You know, my grandfather's got a street named after him in Shelby, mm-hmm. North Carolina. I mean, we've been listening to mountain music for a long time in my family, and we believe that we belong in that scene in Nashville. The buddy thing that also took place in L.A. interested me a lot less. Mm. I don't want friends at my show. I want admirers. I want people that are like-minded artists and contemporaries.
Right.
I don't need to, you pat my back, I'll pat yours. I want to hang out with the good guys.
Right. What, let's talk a little bit about influences. Cause I was thinking about, just what am I trying to say here? Like, who would you cite as your main musical influences? And is that something that evolves over time? Because I think about my musical taste in my adult life has evolved quite a bit. You know, a lot of stuff that I grew up listening to heavy metal records and was hard rock kid. You know what I mean? And sort of discovered other stuff later that I got more into, that I listen to maybe more now. But I'm wondering how much, like, what are your main influences? And do you feel like that evolution as you mature, do you have like a bedrock of where you started? Because I feel like for me, if you like stripped everything back, no matter, I might love fucking Buck Owens or whatever, but if you really fucking pare it back, there's like a little Richie Blackmore inside me that wants right. to play guitar like that.
Right.
And that's the bass line, you know?
That's a great question. And you illustrate it really well. Yeah. Yeah. I think my thing is singing with the boys in fifth grade in the school, you know, singing with the black guys and wanting to be able to sing that well and harmonize like Boys to Men and or you know, the Temptations or whatever it was. It wasn't necessarily one band. I loved Charlotte's culture, man. The people were the way that everybody talked, and then you go out of town and the country people had their way of talking, and the people right. in the city had this beautiful way of talking, and it seemed like every person and every poor kid at my school could sing and dance and play, and they were never going to get the recognition for it. And I wanted to be good in their eyes. I wanted right. to sing good. I wanted the black girls to think I could sing.
Right.
And that Did was they? My. Yeah.
Nice.
There were probably those years when it was so hard to stand out or just get your ass kicked. And my, you know, this is the kind of, I went to the kind of school, it was not the worst, but if you walk down the wrong hall as a, you know, happy bro like me, you'd get your ass kicked for nothing.
Right.
No problem. Right. Big time.
What's Charlotte like to grow up in?
The hard schools are hard, and you saw brutal fights. You saw guns getting brought to school. Mm. You saw a lot of people getting kicked out. Kids that I was in fifth grade in jail, you know, the next year, or what happened to Jermaine? You know, he's in jail now. We weren't from the poor neighborhood, but we were from kind of, I think our rent was probably $650.
Right.
Give you an idea of what we were rolling with. My dad was the pool shark, man, playing guitar and smoking weed and selling weed. And my mom was Yes. My mom
pool shark.
Yes. Master. Yeah. Nine ball.
No shit.
Yeah. And he'd roll up. It was, you know, I'm out and he'd roll up and be like, I'm running up to the corner. And I'd be like, what the fuck? This guy's got to go to the corner three times a day. Why don't you just get everything at once? You know,
right.
he's selling a bag of and try to keep it out of the house.
Yeah.
So it was exciting. And then, you know, dude, we had this other influence. And my mom worked for the temple and was like the cantor, you know, at the same time. We had this connection.
Oh,
my,
really?
My dad was a raised Jewish but didn't do it. But my mom really fell in love with being a Southern Baptist girl.
Right.
And so then we had that influence. And a lot of the classical influence and those going to the JCC, man, and hanging with those boys. Dude, they were terrible at basketball, but they were funny as hell.
Right.
And that was a good influence because it also showed me those kids in my neighborhood, dude, I'm telling you, 9 out of 10 are crack kids.
Right. Crazy.
You just knew what was going on in their houses right, and their dads. Right.
And these weren't kids that necessarily had the dream of being a musician. They just
What did you know? I'm wondering
just
about
part
that.
Of the culture.
When yeah. I was 11, I was just going, "This ain't good enough."
Right. Did you know at that age? Did you know early on that you the path you wanted to go on?
The way that back to that thing where I was just trying to get attention from girls and get attention from people that I admired. And I remember one time I was playing basketball and I wanted to go play with the black guys because they could play with the white guys. It was goofy over there, but I could play, you know, and they wouldn't let me play. And the one dude stood up for me like, "He ain't white." And the dude was like, "I don't play with white boys." And the dude was like, "He ain't white. He's Jew." And I was like, and they're like, "All right, cool." That was Charlotte for me, man. It was just this mashup, and I had these influences. And my mom took me to Temple and I sung in the choir, and then I'd go back and stay out all night chasing some girl until 3 a.m. And my parents didn't care. They weren't, it was just not like that.
Yeah.
So it was loose. And when I was young, I remember going, yeah. And I remember also looking at my friends going, "Don't sniff the gasoline out of it. What are you doing?"
Right.
We got a thing to do, man. Yeah. We're going to be great. Yeah. Seeing those guys give up on greatness and art when they got in their teenage years, start smoking cigarettes, start drinking earlier. Of course, you know, I'm a party animal at this point, but seeing that was also kind of like, No, don't do that.
That is one of the things that freaks me out that I think about a lot as a parent. Is I knew so many other kids, young kids, you know, kids younger than where my kids are at now, that were doing exactly what you're talking about growing up.
Yes.
That you, like, I don't see that happening around my kids' friends, but what the fuck do I know? I'm not there. You know what I mean? And that's just the idea of, like, my 15-year-old doing the shit that me and my friends were doing when I was 15. And I don't think that they are. But, you know, really, how the fuck do I know?
You don't know. I mean, and that's the thing is that you want to, it's like, you do your best to bring them up in a place. You know, I got a 9-month-old daughter, man. I mean, I want her to just be on tour. Like, I don't want to take childhood completely out of it. Right. Like, you're going to be dope on bass when you're 8 and you're joining the band. I'm moving on to Oregon.
Yeah.
You know? I had a lot of nerve. I remember getting the coke and all the stuff passed to me early when we're teenagers and just going, no, I just had that ability. I believed in myself. I did. Yeah,
that's great.
And
I didn't have that strength.
Really? Dude, that's the thing about your people around you. And you know, if some of the guys are admirable or if they're a great surfer, the people around me were really not getting much done after we were little boys and playing football. And when these guys, I mean, I just remember like Straight Outta Compton came out. In Charlotte, that was it for my brother. That was it. He was a gangster after that.
Right. Interesting.
That was that. The relationship between he and my family, that was it.
Hmm.
They took that thing to heart so much, and that was it. I remember that very event.
That is another parenting thing that I think about a lot is like, I always poo-pooed the idea that like rock and roll was a bad influence, you know, when I was younger and would hear it. But the fact of the matter is I wanted to do a lot of stuff that I wanted to do at a very young age because I thought that's what Keith Richards was up to.
Right.
You know what I mean? So I think that there is, you know, I'm not saying we should all be fucking Puritans or anything at all, but like there is some truth to that. Like, you know, art can have a kind of a negative impact.
I wonder about Keith, just for that example, was it totally necessary to have a bottle of whiskey in every photograph? You know?
Right. Jimmy Page or any of those cats. I mean,
did you even drink any of it?
Right. Well, I probably think that they did.
They probably did, but you know what I'm saying?
Right.
You don't have to cuss to sound smarter. You don't have to have a bottle in the picture to look. I want Jerry, because Jerry had the worst of them, but he ain't going to tell nobody. He ain't going to glorify nothing, man.
Right.
You know, I think that's, don't worry about what I'm doing because that's not what this life is about. And that is a mantra. That's a big deal.
Mm.
He ain't trying to sway nobody, like me or don't. But yeah, I agree with you. The glory, you know, it makes a lot of guys run out of gas, man. And because they're thinking about, look, there's a lot of, I don't want to bring up any names, but it's hard to keep rolling. And if you have disillusionment about what happened, I went through it.
Yeah.
Imagine you compound that Atlantic thing, that fall, that gigantic fall. I walked in New York and saw my cutout next to Robert Plant and Aretha Franklin in the office of Atlantic.
Yeah.
Imagine a shit for brains redneck like me with never read a book, what that would do to your ego. That's already, you know, you've already been telling everybody to fuck off. I'm smarter than everybody. And then you got that. Yeah. You did it.
I mean, that had to have had a positive impact on you. It's either going to fucking rip you to pieces or you're going to come out the other end stronger for it. And
I think the
clearly,
first one.
Like, you don't seem like an egomaniacal lunatic at this point, so it must have done something good for you.
I think the fall was what happened.
Right.
I think the false shell fell off during that long false and going from having my $4,000 a month apartment in Manhattan Beach just sleeping in the back of the truck on the side of the highway.
Hmm.
No, I was terrible. I was mean. I was mean and I was terrible to everyone.
Well, how did you find surfing? If you grew up in Charlotte, was that something you came to in Los Angeles?
One of my best dudes in Charlotte was this cat, Billy Sweat. He might hear this. He's still alive. He was the most talented guy in the neighborhood. He was older than me. He smoked Newports. He could kill you at basketball, football, baseball, draw with left hand, right hand, play, sing, rap. The girls loved him. I really liked Billy and I wanted to hang. I'd go over to his house every day in the summer. Billy's crazy ass, this bro who was really infatuated with rap music, got surfing magazines delivered to his house in Charlotte, North Carolina. And we would sit there and look at the pictures and draw the surfers. And I never stopped thinking about surfing my whole life, even never having done it once. Moved to Hollywood. I'm moving to Cali. I'm going to get a record deal.
Right, right.
And I'm going to go to Hermosa. That's what. And then I went, maybe Hollywood's a better choice. The moment that I could move to the beach, I did. And I learned how to surf.
That's a great story. I came to surfing like as an adult too. Even though I grew up at the beach,
right.
I was like a boogie boarder, bodyboarder. Uh-huh. I'm almost ashamed to admit now.
It's part of the thing.
I know, but like I didn't really start surfing till my mid-20s.
Me
you
too.
Know?
I started at 25.
Yeah. Yeah. Same. Yeah. Yeah. Awesome.
Dude, I got to town and fucking had the TV job and pulling my girl, I'll fly her out. You know, I'd make her leave med school and she comes out. And then the bros right across the street, "What's up, man?" And I'm like, "I don't know. I'm bringing a joint over." Like the killingest surfers in town. They took me under their arm.
Nice.
Didn't let me get my ass kicked. Show me how to duck dive.
Right, right,
don't
right.
Don't go in today. Tomorrow yeah, yeah. It'll be better. Go
taught
in.
You the etiquette.
Yes.
Taught you the etiquette.
9 a.m. the waves will be coming. Low tide, right. High tide, swell. The time between waves. Do
right,
you, do you
right.
count those? That's to let you know how fast those babies are coming and how much your ass is getting ready to get kicked.
It's so great to be a Grom at like age 25, age 28. Right. Like, you know, and those, I was so surf mad.
Right.
Like I just wanted to go surf all the time. I didn't have kids yet.
Exactly.
You know what I mean? It was fucking awesome.
My boy took me to Black's Beach and I had like a 11-foot monster and it was like 12-foot wave,
15-foot
right. waves. And I'm out there to finally make it out. And, yeah. and the dude's already like killing it and getting yeah, pictures yeah. taken. And I'm sitting in the lineup in the old, and they knew just by how I was sitting on my board that
right.
I wasn't good.
Right.
And they were like, "Not really a longboard day." You know, I'm going, "What's that mean?" You know,
yeah,
like,
it's funny. I took my 15-year-old a couple months ago to go surf the pier at Venice.
Nice.
And he'd never surfed down there. You know, he surfs like Santa Monica or what in Malibu,
that's
you know,
great.
During the summertime. So I took him to Venice. Like, you know, I don't know if you ever spent much time surfing Venice, but it's got like all
once.
The characters that you would assume it would have.
Yeah, they'll drown you.
So I was sitting there and I was kind of pointing out to him, like, "Okay, just give that guy some room."
Yes.
That guy's serious.
That shaved head guy with tattoos all over
right.
the
place. Yeah, yeah. yeah.
He'll dunk you.
Yeah, stay a little away from that guy. And then there were these other two guys kind of just over from us, and one of them had like a hat on, and I think maybe gloves and booties and a spring suit. And he was on a soft top. And I was like, "Hey, buddy, you can drop in on that guy all day."
Yeah, that's how they like it.
Yeah.
Yeah, they the Kook Patrol, man. I got a lot of... No one... I mean, I almost got beat up one time. I got surrounded one time at El Porto when I dropped in. And it was way too mackin', and I was way out of my league. And I kicked my board out from under me. And the thing went leash out. And like one of the best... female like teenage surfers was coming out to dive under.
Ooh.
And that thing went zing.
Oh, and, like, Jesus.
6 inches from her face.
Yeah.
And the big guys saw it and came over and scared me pretty good. You know?
Yeah.
I was ready to fight. I'm like, "What the fuck are you doing?" Like, "We're in the middle of
yeah. you motherfucker. Yeah. I'm on Atlantic Records. God damn
it. I'm on Atlantic, motherfucker.
Yeah. Yeah.
I'm on the Carson Daly Show." Surfing, I mean, you know, you and I both know that you're going to be confronted with some serious parts of almost dying. If you're really charging and trying things and if you don't know what you're doing. So I've in Mexico especially, I've come out of the water and kissed the sand a few times.
Yeah, I bet. I bet. Yeah. Well, cool, man. Thanks for coming and doing this today, man.
Great pleasure.
Appreciate it. Yeah, it's fantastic.
I love this, Chris.
Great chat.
Great. Thanks for the questions, man.
Yeah.
Awesome. Knows who's holding?
Oh, yes. Check out all that fine Corinthian leather with Joe Firstman from the Cordovas on Walking the Floor. Make sure you get on over to walkingthefloor.com. I'm going to put some links up there so you can check out some of the cool stuff we talked about and go buy his tickets and support the scene, man. And when you're done with that, get on over to chrisshiflettmusic.com and buy those tickets for the West Coast and stream my new tunes up in the Spotify's and the Amazons and the Apple Musics. And I will see y'all in a couple weeks. This is Chris Shiflett, over and out. Adios, amigos!